Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the drug trust right after this. You know, when the federal income tax was launched back in 1913, the tax was levied only on the super wealthy, the richest one-half of 1% of our population, with a top tax rate of only 7%. Today, of course, the fears of the early opponents of this tax have been more than fully realized. By the end of Herbert Hoover's term in office, the top tax rate had jumped to 60%. And by the time Franklin D. Roosevelt was done, the top rate was over 90%. And the income tax had been dramatically expanded to seize the incomes of the middle class for the first time. In 1913, the average family had to work until January 30th to earn enough to satisfy the tax man at every level. This year, the average American family had to work through May 12th in order to earn enough to pay their federal, state, and local tax bills. Now, when we compare this to the plight of medieval serfs, says economist Daniel J. Mitchell, they only had to give the lord of the manor a third of their output, and they were considered slaves. Now, what does that make us today? This income tax and Social Security tax violate three of the Ten Commandments and eight statutes of the Old Covenant, and that includes our English common law. This income tax and Social Security tax are two criminal activities, and the income tax is the second plank to the Communist Manifesto, and Social Security is the eighth plank to the Communist Manifesto. That's why I contend that you owe it to yourself to at least ask the question, do I really want to participate in this kind of criminal activity? If you'd like more information about tax and status, call us here at the law school. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. While you're at it, be sure to ask for our free general law CD package. That's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, and best of all, it's free. Our school tax and status is available on compact disc for adult home education. And if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, and download that free general law CD package. That's georgegordon.org or georgegordon.com if you want to download that direct right off of the Internet. All right, we're talking about the drug trust. Now, the drug trust is composed of a number of big names and big institutions here in the United States. So reading from Eustace Mullins' book, Murder by Injection, let me take a look here, or let's you and I take a look here at the names, the addresses, the dates, the times, the places, the facts, the witnesses, and the evidence that tells us, well, who's making all the big money in the drug business? It is true there's big money to be made in the illegal drug business. Nobody's arguing that. But there's even bigger money, six times more money to be made in legal drugs than in illegal drugs. And that's why all the smart money is in Washington, D.C., making the laws that make these drugs legal. So we find that the United States still maintains an overwhelming lead in the production and sale of drugs. In the United States, the sale of prescription drugs rose in 1987 by 12.5% to $27 billion. 11 of the 18 leading firms are located here in the United States. Three are located in Switzerland, two in Germany, and two in the United Kingdom. Nutritionist T.J. Fry notes that the drug trust in the United States is controlled by the Rockefeller Group in a cartel relationship with I.G. Farben of Germany. In fact, I.G. Farben was the largest chemical concern in Germany during the 1930s when it engaged in an active cartel agreement with Standard Oil of New Jersey. The Allied military government split it up into three companies after World War II as part of the anti-cartel goals of that period, which was not unlike the famed splitting up of the Standard Oil monopoly by court order, while the Rockefellers maintained controlling interest in each of the new companies. All right, so let's pause here and let's think about this. Remember when the Sherman Antitrust Act was brought to bear against the Standard Oil monopoly? They broke it up into a number of smaller companies, of which now, instead of Rockefeller owning the majority interest in Standard Oil, he now has the majority interest in Standard Oil, Exxon, Mobil, and a couple others. So it really doesn't change anything, but the cover story is that it's changed something. That's the important thing. So government gets into the act, and the government acts like your champion. We are going to protect you from these monopolists. Well, if they were going to protect us from the monopolists, how does it protect us by letting Rockefeller keep the majority interest in four oil companies instead of one? How does that do anything for us? Well, the answer is it doesn't, but then it wasn't intended to. Now, while we're talking about monopolists here, the single biggest stockholder in IG Farben is Queen Elizabeth of England, and she owned 65% of that company last time I checked, 65%. And while we're at it, Queen Elizabeth is not English, she's German, and her name isn't Windsor, it's Saxe-Gotha. Now, how's that for blowing your socks off? So here's the Queen of England, who is in reality a German, who changed their name during World War I to Windsor from Saxe-Gotha because it was embarrassing as hell to be at war with Germany while you're the German queen. So it just kind of gives you a little insight into the machinations that go on here behind the scenes, behind these public officials, in this case the queen. But it also, it goes into the president of the United States, and it takes up powerful industry heads, you know, like the chairman of the board of Citicorp and Bank of America, and the interlocking bank boards. You know, these families and cartels control all of these big businesses and the law firms that represent these big businesses. And then the government politicians and all of the minions that sit in the Congress of the United States. And while it's true they don't control every single one of them every single day of the week, they have enough influence and enough control over most of them most of the time to create the policy that we need in order to accomplish the goals that we've set before us. That's what the cartel is doing. Now, in Germany, William Draper of Dillon Reed Investment Bankers unveiled a new decree from his office in the IG Farben building. Henceforth, IG Farben would exist no more, and instead three companies would emerge: Bayer of Leverkusen, BASF of Ludwigshafen, and Horsch near Frankfurt. And each of these three is now larger than the old IG Farben company. Only ICI of England is larger. Now, these firms export more than half of their product. BASF is represented in the United States by Shearman and Sterling, the Rockefeller law firm in which William Rockefeller is a partner. The world's number one drug firm, Merck, began as an apothecary shop in Darmstadt, Germany in 1668. Its president today, John J. Horan, is a partner of J.P. Morgan Company and the Morgan Guarantee Trust. He attended a Bilderberger meeting in Rye, New York on May 10th through the 12th in 1985. In 1953, Merck absorbed another large drug firm, Sharp and Dohme. And at that time, Oscar Ewing, the central figure in the government fluoridation promotion for the Aluminum Trust, was secretary of the Merck firm, his office then being at number 1 Wall Street in New York City. Directors of Merck include John T. Connor, who began his business career with Kravath, Swain & Moore, the law firm for Kuhn Loeb & Company. Connor then joined the Office of Naval Research, became Special Assistant to the Secretary of the Navy from 1945 to 47. He became President of Merck, then President of Allied Stores from 1967 to 80, then Chairman of Schroders, the London banking firm. Connor is also a director of a competing drug firm, Warner Lambert, director of the media conglomerate Capital Cities ABC, and director of Rockefeller's Chase Manhattan Bank. Each of the major drug firms in the United States has at least one director with close Rockefeller connections or with a Rothschild bank. Another director of Merck is John K. McKinley, chief operating officer of Texaco. He's also a director of Manufacturers Hanover Bank, which congressional records identify as a major Rothschild bank. McKinley is also a director of the aircraft firm Martin Marietta, Burlington Industries, and is a director of the aircraft firm Martin Marietta, Burlington Industries, and is a director of the Rockefeller-controlled Sloan Kettering Cancer Institute. Another Merck director is Reuben F. Mettler. He's chairman of the defense contractor TRW Incorporated. He was formerly chief of the guided missiles department at Ramo Wooldridge and has received the Human Relations Award from the National Conference of Christians and Jews. He's also a director of Bank of America. Now, notice what's important here with these interlocking bank boards. You got one guy here, and he's on 6 or 8. So let's suppose that one of these companies over here adopts a policy. Let's take Martin Marietta, and they adopt a policy. Well, the Rockefeller banks then have a direct line right into the board of directors, don't they? For intelligence purposes, they know exactly what Martin Marietta is doing at any given time, don't they? Which then gives them the opportunity to say, wait a minute, we can't have that going on. So then they go to the whole board of directors and say, hey, listen, we don't like that. That's not a good plan. And if the board were to get uppity with them, well, then they can bring power to bear, such as, oh, you want that contract from the Defense Department? Well, you're not going to get it until you change that policy. See how simple that is? So the people at the top control the pyramid from the top as it spreads out down to the bottom. So the politicians, like Barack Obama, important fellow, President of the United States. But he's not the guy that pulls the strings. He's a marionette, and the strings are pulled, and Barack Obama dances. And if he gets uppity like Ronald Reagan did, he'll get shot. And if he gets uppity like John F. Kennedy, he may get killed. Now, from time to time, we have had politicians in office that have blown the whistle on what the bankers and the Illuminati are doing. It occurs once in a while. It's rare, but it does occur. Going on, other directors of Merck include Frank T. Carey, who was chairman of IBM for many years. He's also a director of Capital Cities ABC and partner of J.P. Morgan Company. Lloyd C. Elam, president of McCary Medical College, Nashville, Tennessee, the nation's only black medical college. Elam is also a director of the American Psychiatric Association, Nashville City Bank, and the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, which gives him a close connection to the Rockefeller Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. Marion Schulzberger Heskel, heiress of the New York Times fortune, she was married to Orville Dreyfus, the paper's editor, who died of a heart attack during a newspaper strike. She then married Andrew Heiskel in a media merger. He was chairman of Time Magazine and had been with the Luce organization for 50 years. She's also a director of the Ford Motor Company. Heiskel is director of People for the American Way, a political activist group, chairman of the New York Public Library, and the Book of the Month Club. Also on the board of Merck is a family member, Albert W. Merck, Reginald H. Jones, born in England, formerly chairman of General Electric, now chairman of the Board of Overseers, Wharton School of Commerce, director of Allied Stores, and General Signal Corporation. Now, I want to point out that this guy Heiskel over here, remember, he's on the board of directors of the Book of the Month Club. That's a very important position because it gives him a position to impose censorship. For instance, the book that we're getting this information from Murder by Injection is one of the books that's censored. You're not going to find this book in the Book of the Month Club. You're not going to find this book in any public library in the United States of America unless it's in some little byway. I mean, you might find this book in the Gainesville Public Library, some little library, but you're not going to find it in Los Angeles or New York or Chicago. And that's because, as I pointed out in earlier programs, it's been censored. And the Illuminati are able to censor what you and I hear in the mainstream press. Now, there is some information out there, as I point out from time to time. You can get it from Spiker, Namila. You get it from Mullins. You get it here on the Law Hour. There are media information outlets out there, but they're very rare. If you took all of the underground press and you put it all together, it wouldn't represent 1% of CBS. It wouldn't represent the power, the prestige, or the number of people that listen to just a Katie Couric on the CBS Evening News. There's a few thousand people here in America that listen to and are informed by the underground press, not millions. Hell, Katie Couric, I think, talks to several million a night. Now, her presentation on the CBS Evening News is a well-rehearsed and carefully orchestrated presentation of the information that you and I are supposed to hear. And as Adolf Hitler pointed out, he said, you know, you tell a lie often enough and over, people will believe it. Evolution's as phony as a $3 bill, and you know it as well as I do, but we all believe it because it's the only thing we hear. It's the only thing we hear. And so we give credibility. I was talking to my boy the other day, and he said, well, back during the Cambrian period, I said, Dirk, wake up and smell the coffee. There's never been a Cambrian period. You're talking about Noah's flood. And he said, oh, yeah. See, it's in our language, for crying out loud. When we want to talk about a period in the past, we talk about the Jurassic period, like Jurassic Park, the movie, which occurred during Noah's flood, is what you're talking about here. Now, going on, other directors of Merck include Frank T. Carey, who was chairman of IBM for many years. He's also a director of Capital Cities ABC. Then there's a guy named Paul G. Rogers down here. He served in Congress from the 84th to the 95th Congress. He was chairman of the important Subcommittee on Health. In 1979, he joined the influential Washington law firm and lobbyist Hogan & Hartson. He's also a director of the American Cancer Society, the RAND Corporation, and Mutual Life Insurance. Now, when you serve time in the Congress, and then you get out, then you go to work, and that's where the money is made. So you don't make any money as a senator. You get power and prestige, you know. Like Ted Kennedy, he was on the outs with the Illuminati. He's the only Kennedy brother that died of old age, and all the rest of them were murdered. Joe Jr., we don't know how he got killed in World War II. His airplane blew up, but we don't know who set the fuse on the airplane. And, of course, you saw what happened to Kennedy. See, the Kennedys are outsiders trying to get to the inside. And they got killed in the process. There might have actually been some good come out of that Kennedy thing, see, but Bottom line is that they got crosswise with the powers that be and ended up dead. Ronald Reagan almost ended up dead. They had him marked for assassination. And if you'll notice, after he was shot, he straightened out. And he followed the strict party line from that point on throughout his presidency. I personally knew a senator from Idaho. His name was Steve Sims. He served one term. He's the guy that upset Senator Frank Church. Sims was an apple grower out in Owyhee County. He was an honest farmer, nice guy, conservative. He served one term, and you couldn't tell his vote from Frank Church after the first year or two. And what happens when these politicians get into office? See, all of us in our lifetimes do things that we wish we hadn't. So let's suppose that I was elected senator from Missouri. And then, you know, you all get behind me and you say, yeah, George Gordon, he's a pretty good guy. We're going to send him to Washington. Well, as soon as I get to Washington, I would be contacted by a lobbyist group. And they would bring out my dossier and they'd say, now, Mr. Gordon, when you were 17 years old and 22 years old and 30 years old, here are some of the things that you did. Now, nobody knows about these things, and we certainly aren't going to tell anybody about these things now, are we? Now, Mr. Gordon, we hope to have a good working relationship with you here in the Senate of the United States, and we have some proposals, and we would like your support. The Merck Company would like your support on this bill. The steel industry would like your vote on this bill. And you see what would happen to me? Well, it's either that or they're going to expose all the skeletons in my closet. And boy, you know, there's just not very many people out there that don't have skeletons in their closet. And I suspect that Steve Sims was probably out, you know, he probably had a mistress on the side or something like that. Or he was married and he had an abortion, or maybe he belonged to the Communist Party at some time. And in order to keep from being exposed, you know, he was getting blackmailed. And so he voted just like Frank Church voted. So when we changed from Frank Church to Steve Sims, the first 2 years were pretty good, but then Steve, you know, he kind of jumped the tracks of sanity. Now, that's the way this game is being played. Now, if you play the game in the Congress, then when you come out, you can get a job at Merck. You can get a job with the lobbying firms. And so when picture this. Remember the guy that ran for president in 2000, Al Gore? Well, Al Gore wasn't poor. He had $2 or $3 million. His daddy was a senator from Tennessee, and Al Gore was a senator from Tennessee. Then he became vice president, and then he ran for president. I don't know what the payoff was, but you know, in the 2000 election. But here's what happened. Today, Al Gore has been paid more than $100 million. The guy's got $100 million. In 8 years, the guy went from $2 or $3 million to $100 million. And it's growing. Now, he's the guy that's spearheading this global warming deal. And this global warming deal is going to produce trillions of dollars in taxes and profits for the oil industry and the coal industry. I mean, this cap and trade bill that's in the process of going through Congress right now, well, that's Al Gore's job. His job now is he's no longer vice president. He's getting paid. As vice president, he was getting paid, you know, what, $100,000 a year? Hell, that guy's getting paid millions of dollars a year now for doing what he's doing. I mean, this is where the payoff comes. So, you know, you don't need to feel sorry for Al Gore. He's doing fine. It's true he didn't make president of the United States, but, hey, listen, he was vice president, and hey, that guy's getting paid handsomely. That's the benefit that you get from being a good minion while you're in political office. So we find that the world's number one drug firm has two directors who are partners of J.P. Morgan Company, one who is director of the Rockefeller Chase Manhattan Bank, and one who is director of the Rothschild Bank. Manufacturers Hanover, most of the directors are connected with vital defense industries and interlock with other defense firms. And on the board of TRW, of which Reuben Mettler is co-chairman, is William H. Chrome George, former chairman of Alcoa, and Martin Feldstein, former economic advisor to President Reagan. The major banks, defense firms, and prominent political figures interlock with the CIA and the drug firms. Hey, it's all in the family. It's just business, and it's all in the family. The number two drug firm is Glaxo Holdings with $3.4 billion in sales. Its chairman is Austin Bide, or Bide, B-I-D-E. Deputy chairman is P. Girolami, who is director of National Westminster Bank, one of England's big five. Directors are Sir Alastair Frame, chairman of Rio Tinto Zinc, one of the three firms which are the basis of the Rothschild fortune. Frame is also on the board of another Rothschild holding, the well-known munitions firm Vickers. Also, Pressey, another defense firm which recently bid on a large contract with the U.S. Army. Frame is president of Brit Oil and director of Glaxo, or Lord Fraser of Kilmarnock, who was deputy chairman of the Conservative Party, now the ruling party in England. Well, they're out of office now, but this book was written in 1988. From 1946 to 75, when he joined Glaxo, Lord Fraser was also a member of the influential Shadow Cabinet. B.D. Taylor, counselor of Victoria College of Pharmacy and chairman of Waxham Hospital. Then there's J.M. Raisman, chairman of Shell Oil UK Limited. That's another Rothschild-controlled firm. Lloyds Bank, one of the big five, British Telecommunications and Royal Committee on Environmental Pollution. Sir Ronald Arculus, A-R-C-U-L-U-S, retired from Her Majesty's Diplomatic Service after a distinguished career. He had served in San Francisco, New York, Washington, and Paris. He was then appointed ambassador to Italy and was the UK delegate to the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, which sought to apportion marine wealth among the have-not countries. Arculus is now director of Trust House, Forte Hotels, and London and Continental Bankers. And Professor R.G. Derendorf, one of the world's most active sociologists and a longtime Marxist propagandist. Dollendorf, a director of the Ford Foundation since 1976, is a graduate of the London School of Economics, professor of sociology at Hamburg and at Tübingen, parliamentary secretary of state at the Foreign Office of West Germany since 1969, and has received honors from Senegal, Luxembourg, and Leopold II. Now, the Rothschilds apparently appointed Derendorf a director of Glaxo because of his emphatic Marxist pronouncements. The European director of the Ford Foundation, he claims, in his book, Marx in Perspective, that Marx is the greatest factor in the emergence of modern society. Derendorf's principal contribution to sociology has been his well-advertised concept of the new man, whom he has dubbed Homo sociologicus, a being who has been transformed by socialism into a person whose every distinctive feature, including racial characteristics, have disappeared. He is the modern robot, a uniform creature who can easily be controlled by the force of world socialism. Derendorf is the apostle of the modern faith that there are no racial differences in any of the various races of mankind. He denounces any mention of superiority or of differing skills as ideological distortion. Derendorf is a prominent member of the Bilderbergers. He attended their meeting at Rye, New York from May 10th to the 12th, 1985. He is professor of sociology at Konstanz University, as well as his other previous mentioned posts. Let me put my arrow right there and give you your mid-course reminder that you're listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from a scriptural perspective, non-state schools and all. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly and has a radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, go to our website, georgegordon.org or georgegordon.com. Go to our archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package right there in the privacy of your own home without the inconvenience of a plain brown envelope coming to you in the mail. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements, these recommendations that we give, don't mean that the authors or publications that we endorse are necessarily going to reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour either. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine, they're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. We are reviewing a chapter called The Drug Trust in the book Murder by Injection by Eustace Mullins. You can get a copy of the book. Well documented. Got all kinds of facts and figures, names, dates, times, places, facts, witnesses, and evidence here. And you can get a copy of it from bravenewbookstore.com. Just go to the webpage, bravenewbookstore.com, or you can call them direct at 512-480-2503. That's in Austin, Texas. That number again, 512 480-2503. If you're in Austin, Texas, you can go to the bookstore. It's at 1904 Guadalupe Street, Suite B, Austin, Texas, 78705. That's where you get all of the underground books. If you're looking for a book that's been censored here in the United States, they'll have it or they can get it for you. If they don't have it, they'll get it. And that's Brave New Bookstore, 1904 Guadalupe Street, Suite B, in Austin, Texas, 78705. Now, Eustace Mullins is an old man. I don't know how old this guy is, but 20 years ago, he was an old man, and I was about 50. And if he's still alive, he has to be 90. And I haven't heard of his demise. So, as far as I know, Eustace Mullins is still out there kicking. He's written about 10 books, and he's good at what he does. And he's taken the time, as you can see here, to research out these interlocking bank boards, interlocking boards of directors of defense industries, pharmaceutical industries, politicians, who's in office at what time, what their careers were made up of. He goes to who's who and digs them out year after year. I mean, this is a lot of work, a lot of work. And this guy knows his onions. Now, I'm just a crummy reporter, so a lot of times people call me and they say, oh, my God, you must be the smartest man God ever put breath into. And I appreciate your vote of confidence. Now, the truth of the matter is I'm as dumb as a box of rocks, and I don't deny it. As old Will Rogers used to say, all I know is what I read in the papers. Hell, I wouldn't have known any of this if Eustace Mullins hadn't researched it out. I'm not the guy that went and got this information for you. I wish I had. Hell, I wish I was smart enough to go find it. I go up to my boy Dirk and I say, Dirk, go get this information. He gets on Google or Yahoo or somebody and he digs it out and he finds J. Richard Nimella. Remember in the last program I gave you a report here on the profitability of the pharmaceutical industry. Hell, I didn't know that. So I'm just learning like you, and I'm just Joe Sixpack out here. But I get the information, and I said, you know, I think the rest of us out there ought to know this. When I dig out a story like this one here on the Drug Trust, I say to myself, well, I wonder how many other Joe Sixpacks and Sally Housewives out there have ever heard of these people, these names, and their connections with the Rothschild Bank and the Rockefellers and the Bilderbergers and Trilateral Commissions and David Rockefeller and so on. I wonder if they knew what their connections were. It's not only interesting, but it's also relevant and up-to-date as it relates to Bible prophecy. Because what we see going on around us, this economic meltdown, this isn't an accident. This is a result of a carefully contrived program to bring the world into a new world order. This is the take-up from the Tower of Babel, from the time that God himself intervened in the geopolitical course of human events at the Tower of Babel. We have been working, we human beings, behind the scenes, you know, maybe not you, Joe, but your princes in the political powers and the bankers and the industrialists and the businessmen have been working to create this one world government, working hand in glove with Satan himself to thwart the plan of the creator of the universe. And they've been working mightily for 3,000 or 4,000 years, and God love them, I'm sure they're just out there doing their best for you. For you. I think that these megalomaniacs actually believe that they're doing God's service to do this. And in the process, they're bringing about a period of time called in the Bible the Great Tribulation. That's what Jesus called it in Matthew 24. It's referred to as Jacob's Trouble. It's referred to in the book of Revelation as the end times. Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Daniel all wrote about it in the Bible. And here it is, right here in front of us, you know, in spades. Right here in front of us. Now we're getting the names, dates, times, places, facts, witnesses, and evidence. Now listen to this. Thus we find that the world's number two drug firm is directed by two of the Rothschild family, their family's most trusted henchmen, and by the world's most outspoken exploitative of Marxism. The world's number three drug firm, Hoffmann La Roche of Switzerland, is still controlled by members of the Hoffmann family, although there have been rumors of takeover attempts in recent years. The firm was founded by Fritz Hoffmann, who died in 1920. The firm's first big seller was Serapin in 1896. Its sales of Valium and Librium now amount to $1 billion a year. Its subsidiary spread the dangerous chemical dioxin over the Italian town Seveso, which cost $150 million to clean up in a 10-year campaign. His son's widow, Maya Sacker, is now married to Paul Sacker, a musician who is conductor of the Basel Chamber of Orchestra. Hoffman had added his wife's name, LaRoche, to the family company, as is the custom in Europe. The Hoffmans still control 75% of the voting shares. The Sackers have one of the world's most expensive art collections, old masters and modern paintings. In 1987, Hoffman LaRoche tried to take over Sterling Drug, a venture in which they were aided by Lewis Preston, chairman of J.P. Morgan Company. He also happened to be Sterling's banker. In the ensuing brouhaha, Preston decided to retire. Eastman Kodak then bought Sterling, with backing from the Rockefellers. The chairman of Hoffman LaRoche is Fritz Gerber, a 58-year-old Swiss Army colonel. The son of a carpenter, he became a lawyer, then chairman of Hoffman LaRoche. Gerber is also a director of Zurich Insurance, thus he is associated with Switzerland's two biggest firms. He draws a salary of 2.3 million Swiss francs per year, plus 1.7 million working agreement with Glaxo Holdings. Hoffman LaRoche received a great deal of publicity in April 1988 because of unfavorable revelations about its acne drug, Accutane, after the Food and Drug Administration publicized figures that the drug had caused 1,000 spontaneous abortions, 7,000 other abortions and other side effects such as joint aches, drying of skin and mucous membranes, and hair loss. Hoffman LaRoche was faulted by the FDA for purposely omitting women, and particularly pregnant women, from the studies on which it based requests for approval of Accutane. The company was aware that Accutane caused serious effects when taken during pregnancy. Now I'm going to put an arrow here in my margin, and let's comment on this. These drugs have side effects. All drugs have side effects. Drugs, of and by themselves, are scripturally a violation of the Ten Commandments. They are, in fact, a practice of witchcraft. Witchcraft is strictly prohibited in Scripture. In fact, it carries the death penalty. Death penalty. It's a serious felony and not to be participated in. So when you go into the drugstore and you buy a bottle of aspirin, or you go in and you buy this prescription drug and so on, with few exceptions. Now, there are some exceptions. Some of these are herbal remedies, which are foods mentioned in the Bible. And there's a distinction now between the witch's brew, which is prohibited, and herbs, which are foods. And so when you're taking vitamins, you're taking foods. When you're taking aspirin, you're taking a drug. When you're taking willow bark, you're taking an herb. So what the drug companies do is they take willow bark, which is the natural herb that we call aspirin today. They synthesize it through chemistry, and they convert it into the witch's brew, which is now witchcraft. I mean, that's how simple it is, no big mystery. And they make buku bucks, because this willow bark, an herb, takes time, effort, and energy to extract. And it's a slow, methodical process, and it's expensive. And aspirin is cheap. It's made out of coal tar. It doesn't take much to make these chemicals, to make drugs. And these chemicals cause damage. They're not designed for your body, like herbs are. Herbs are foods. They contain enzymes and vitamins and minerals and so on. They're designed, and your body's designed to assimilate them. When you chemically alter those, your body rejects it, has side effects. We call those allergies. And in some cases, it'll kill you, or in some cases, it'll make you go blind or lose your hair, or all these side effects that go with it. But they're god-awful profitable. I showed you that in the last program. I mean, money's money. Now, this is why herbal medicine, at the turn of the century, from the naturopaths and the homeopaths, fell into disuse, because the Rockefellers couldn't make any money with that. When you go to make herbs and herbal remedies, that takes time, effort, and energy. It costs money. It's not cheap, and it's not nearly as profitable as synthesizing this from coal tar and then mass producing it. Now, you can get the same results from aspirin that you do from willow bark, but you get the side effects that go with them, and that's the point that we're making here. So just tuck that away in your heart, and the cure can be as bad as or worse than the disease. Now, hard on the heels of the Accutane revelations, Hoffman LaRoche made new headlines in the Wall Street Journal with Congressman Ted Weiss in a demand reported on May 6, 1988, that a criminal investigation be launched of the 40 deaths recorded since 1986 caused by taking Verst Hoffman LaRoche's tranquilizer, which is a chemical cousin of its best-selling drug Valium. The number four drug firm, Smith, Kline, Beckman, banks with the Mellon Bank. Its chairman, Robert F.D., is a director of General Foods, Air Products and Chemical, and the defense firm United Technologies, which interlocks with Citibank. Directors are Samuel H. Ballum, Jr., chairman of the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania, director of American Water Works, Westmoreland Coal Company, General Coal Company, INA Investment Securities, chairman of Cigna's High Yield Fund, and Geothermal Resources International. Now, let me pause here for a moment. Let's make an observation here with the Hoffman LaRoche paragraph here, where they got sued. When these guys get sued, how much damage do they pay out? Well, in some cases, it's in the millions. Some of the biggest settlements that have ever been made have been made against these drug companies for putting out bad drugs. If 20 people collected $1 million each, that's a pretty good settlement, wouldn't you say? $1 million, wrongful death. In the final analysis, when we take a look at Hoffman LaRoche, remember they make in the neighborhood $8 billion a year. $8 billion. The Ford Motor Company some years back had a dilemma just like Hoffman LaRoche has. Now, I call it a dilemma because as a businessman, I sympathize with the board of directors and the company and its objectives because I understand business. But at the same time, when your business kills people, which is just a necessary part of, or it's like war. You know, we don't want soldiers to get killed in Afghanistan, but we know that when we send them there, some of them are going to get killed. Not many. It'll be a minority. Out of 60,000 people that are there, we kept 160,000 people for 8 years in Iraq, and we only killed 5,000 of them in 8 years. See, so it's a very small percentage. And the drug companies are doing the same thing. Well, the Ford Motor Company had a problem with their Pinto automobile. The gas tank in the back of the car, when the car got rear-ended, which, you know, you build a million Pinto cars, aren't some of those cars going to get in an auto accident? And when they do, aren't some of the auto accidents going to be rear-end collisions? And when there's a rear-end collision, isn't some of the fuel tanks in those Pintos going to be ruptured? And when they're ruptured, aren't they going to catch on fire? Sometimes. And when they catch on fire, aren't there going to be some people killed? Well, the Pinto automobile, as it turned out, had a faulty design in their gas tank. That was the conclusion that the case came up with. Well, one day, three girls are riding in their Pinto, and it gets rear-ended, and these three girls are burned to death in the car. They all sue, and if you want to know what a blonde, blue-eyed 16-year-old girl is worth, it's $1 million. A dead, burned 16-year-old blonde, blue-eyed girl, dead on the sidewalk, is worth $1 million. And so the Ford company paid out $3 million for these three deaths. Now, as it turned out, the Ford Motor Company had been sued a number of times over this Pinto car. And they figured that to bring all of the Pinto cars in and fix the gas tank was going to cost them $100 million. They just said, well, how many Pintos have we made? And how many faulty gas tanks are there? And if we bring them in and we fix the faulty gas tanks, it's going to cost us, we put out a million cars and 100 bucks each, $100 million. How much money are we paying out in these lawsuits? And the answer is, well, we're paying out about $3 million a year. Well, how many years will these Pintos be on the road? 10 years. So they said $3 million a year in lawsuits times 10 years is $30 million. So they came to the conclusion, well, there's no point in spending $100 million to fix a car that in 10 years isn't even going to be on the road anymore. We'd be $70 million ahead if we just shut up, leave the faulty gas tank right where it's at, and pay out $30 million for 30 dead girls. And that's what they did. Now, the Hoffman LaRoche Company are faced with the same problem. They put out a drug, and they sell it to millions of people. It doesn't kill millions of people. It only kills 20. So should we take a drug off the market that makes, say, $1 billion a year and kills 20 people a year? The answer is hell no. We can pay each one of those 20 people that die $1 million each. Costs us $20 million to make $1,000 million. So we net $980 million by just leaving the drug out there. Yeah, it kills people, and we're sorry as hell. But that's the dilemma that businessmen face. I mean, you know, come on, wake up and smell the coffee. These drugs kill people. There was a drug, a heart drug out there, killed 50,000. When you get out to killing 50,000, that would bankrupt a company. So then they've got to have protection. This is why Dick Armey did such a valuable service to the pharmaceutical industry. Millions of people are vaccinated every year. We've gotten to the point now where one out of every 67 children 67 children out of every 1,000 children have autism. We think it's caused by thimerosal. So the drug industry says, no, 1,000 times no, there's no evidence that that's true. You know, that's what the tobacco industry said. No, 1,000 times no, smoking doesn't cause cancer. 40 years goes by and we sell a lot of cigarettes and make a lot of money. Then one day we wake up and we make a $200 billion settlement. One day the drug industries will wake up and they'll make a big settlement. After they have made $100, $200, $300 billion, $500 billion, God, I don't know how much, and in 40 years later, we'll come to the conclusion that, yes, well, thimerosal did cause autism, and we're just sorry as hell. But you can't sue us because there's a ban against it. Government comes in here and protects a very valuable asset. See, government has a dilemma also. Think about it. The drug companies don't pay any taxes, but they are the collectors of the tax money from you and me. So when we buy the drug, then we pay our $450. About $100 or $200 of that goes to taxes. at all levels, you know, for government, and government's making around 50% of that. In the case of alcohol, you know, Jack Daniel's whiskey, the tax that you're paying when you buy a bottle of whiskey is 75% tax. So when you spend $10 on a bottle of whiskey, $7.50 is tax and $2.50 goes to the distillers and the retailers and everybody else. When you buy an automobile, 46% of that is tax. So when you pay $20,000 for an automobile, $9,000 of that is tax. So government protects the auto industry because it is so valuable as a tax source. Government protects the pharmaceutical industry because it's so valuable as a tax source. See where we're going with this? It's nothing personal, you know, but business is business. And government is business. Government is big business. It is humongous business. Pharmaceuticals are business. It's big business. Automobiles is business. It's big business. Now, these corporations themselves do not pay any taxes, not a nickel. But they are the collectors of the tax, and then they pay that over to government. And for that service, they get rewarded. That's why the lobbyists, when they go to Washington and they say, hey, the auto industry needs this or that, the pharmaceutical industry needs this or that. These are the insiders. These are the people who are on the interlocking bank boards. These are our princes. They're called in the Bible, our princes. And we look up to these people, you know, like Bill Gates. Nice guy, no doubt. But, you know, he's in the inner circle, along with David Rockefeller and everybody else. And if he gets crosswise with the powers that be, then he's going to get eliminated. He doesn't want that. And it's so much easier to join up and prosper than it is to buck them and get killed. I mean, it's just the way life is. And so you and I, the Joe Sixpacks and the Sally Housewives out here, we are being exploited. And so the purpose for my report is if you want to continue to be exploited, just stay on the path that you're on. You can't miss. If you don't want to be exploited, then it's time to get off the path, don't you think? All right, we're about out of time, so I've got to give you a reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has our radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Hey, our time's up. I've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.